If you're like me, you love and miss that golden era of Christian music. From the Jesus music of the 70s, the monster vocalists of the 80s, and the creativity and risk-taking of the 90s and early 2000s. I'm Andy Christman, and for the past four decades, I was privileged to be smack dab in the middle of this crazy and beautiful thing that we call CCM. As a member of the group For Him, I got to know so many great people with even greater stories, and I don't want to keep these stories to myself. That's why I created One Degree of Andy, so you can join me as I reminisce with my friends and colleagues. My hope is that as you experience these conversations, you'll go back and listen to that golden era of music and fall in love all over again, just like I have. This is the One Degree of Andy podcast. I have to tell you that 99.9% of the people that I came in contact with, worked with, toured with, recorded with during my journeys through the world of Christian music were just the best, wonderful people that were talented and loved Jesus and were doing what they were doing for the right reasons. But there are a few people that I think, you know, I have to say rose to the top of that list. And one of those is my friend Jeff Moore. I'm excited to have Jeff on the podcast today to talk about his career, his extraordinary friendship with Stephen Curtis Chapman. There's a lot to dig into there. And then just what God has him doing post his Christian music career. So I'm really excited to have one of the really good guys in Christian music on the pod today, Jeff Moore. And I'll make this next part brief because as you can probably tell by my voice, I've been under the weather a bit this week. If you get a chance, go to my website, andychrisman.com. There you can find out info about my radio show, which is called Worship with Andy Christman, heard on 500 plus stations around the world each and every week. And you can also sign up for my newsletter so that you don't miss anything happening at the pod, at my radio show, and at my ministry, AC Ministries. And please prayerfully consider becoming a premium subscriber. Your support helps us to make this podcast what it is each and every week. Now, here is my conversation with my friend, Jeff Moore. So if I say For Him to people or Point of Grace or Avalon, people go, yeah, I really love them. Or if I say, you know, Rick Kua or Stryper or White Harp, you go, yeah, I love them. But if I say Jeff Moore in the distance, every time I get, yeah, love Jeff Moore, love that band, love the music, you guys, I say the same thing, just a fan. From, you know, back in the days, we're contemporaries. Yeah. I feel like, you know, you started a little earlier, probably than 1990, but just, you know, we were on the radio together. Mm-hmm. We were passing each other. Our buses were passing each other on tour year after year and got to know you that way. We have a lot of friends in common, which we can get to here in just a little bit. Yeah. But, you know, one of the taglines of this podcast is you can't tell the story of Christian music without. And I mean, you're the epitome of that, Jeff, well, in my opinion. You cannot tell the story of Christian music without Jeff Moore. And so, man, I'm just thrilled that, you know, we've been trading texts for a while, just trying to get our schedules. You're a busy dude, and I'm glad you've been able to take time to hang out with me today.
Very happy this worked out. You know, good news is I live about a mile from here, so it was a big commute and we were talking before we started recording that my wife, Jan, was like, so what are you going to do? And as I explained it to her, we both were like, man, it's so great that somebody is helping capture the history of contemporary Christian music because it's, you know, somebody's got to do it, Andy. So I'm glad you're doing it.
Well, I'm trying to do my part. You know, I have talked to people that, you know, there's my largest download area is here in Nashville.
Wow.
And I saw you at Don Cook's funeral just the other day.
Yeah.
And just full of industry people. People I haven't seen in
It was kind of old home
years.
Week. Yeah.
Where I would look at people and we'd look at each other and go, oh my gosh, I know you. Oh, yeah. You were this person in my life. And it was really cool. In fact, I told my wife, you remember that last episode of Lost?
Everybody comes back.
Yeah, everybody comes back to the church and all is forgiven. That's what I felt about at the funeral the other day. But you know, there's a, I think there's a story to be told that, you know, going to Don's funeral, you start talking about the songs.
Yeah.
And what that era was like. And I do believe it's just a hidden gem for some reason. I don't know.
I agree.
It's a hidden gem for people to rediscover.
You know, we were at the same memorial yesterday. Uh-huh. And, was that yesterday?
Yeah, no, 2 days ago.
2 days ago. Sorry. And, you know, just quick, words of honor and gratitude for Don Cook. You know, Don was the very first keyboard player that ever went on the road with me. So yeah. Pre-distance. And when we were living the dream in a cargo van, you know, in fact, I gave his wife a picture of Don driving a cargo van and me like wrapped up in a sleeping bag in the back. And we were obviously messing with each other. And it was just, yeah. So what a sweet man to honor his life. But, I was there, you know, Steve and Chris Chapman and I were there together, and cause we had met Don around the same time and we were in line together, and there was a gentleman in front of us, and he turned around and started talking with us. And at one point, you know, I think emotional because of being at a memorial, but it was, he started just talking about what this era of Christian music meant to his life and like immediately became emotional. And it wasn't really even about a particular song. It was kind of about this like collective work that clearly was like a soundtrack to his life. Yeah. So it was a really sweet reminder.
Yeah. You and I have lived in enough life after kind of our heyday of Christian music where we run into people who we were the soundtrack of their lives for so many people, just like, you know, our heroes that we've met through the years ago, you sang the songs that, you know, got me through my high school years I sang at my wedding and those kinds of things. And so, I'm just happy to help people discover it again.
Yeah.
You know, I love the K-Love app that's got the 90s channel on it. They've got the 80s and 90s, man, I put that thing on all the time. But obviously we're here to tell your story. Like it's all about you. it's funny, you know, I can't think about you without thinking about Stephen as well, because you guys are so close, wrote some big songs together.
Yeah.
And we can talk about that in a little bit too, but, you know, you just have a line through the history of Christian music that I think is very important to talk about and then what you've done afterwards. And so we'll get to all that, but can we start from the top?
Yeah.
Let's start from the beginning of, you know, where you grew up, how you got into music, and when you knew you wanted to do this for a living.
Absolutely. And I think, man, probably like you, I feel like I came up in the golden age of Christian music. You know, I was right in that pivotal piece where I was in high school at the end of the 70s, in college in the early 80s. And that was when contemporary Christian music was really just kind of being born. You know, I grew up in a family where my mom and dad were not Christians until right before I was born. So none of my siblings were raised in a Christian home. Uh-huh. In their early years. And I was, you know, like a 20th anniversary wedding present, I think, to my mom and dad.
But you're the oops baby.
Yeah, right. Yeah. And so.
Same. I was the same way.
So he became when my mom and dad gave their lives to Jesus, they got involved in a really legalistic church, which, you know, for my dad, who was, you know, a mess before he followed Christ, that was great. He was like, just tell me what not to do. Yeah. You know, I want some guardrails. So like legalism was like right up his alley. Not a great place to grow up. And, but in the middle of it, when I was in high school, there was a youth pastor that came to work at the church. And, you know, he was, I guess, a little bit of a rebel. And I remember, so by the time I'm a junior in high school, two things would, you know, if you ever do those parties where it's like two things you don't know about me kind of thing, you know, you'd never guess would be, on the day I graduated from high school, I had never sung or done any music of any kind.
Really?
Yeah. I was in athletics and into the outdoors.
That's wild.
Was a awesome dashboard drummer and, you know, could sing with the radio, but I'll get to that bit of the story. And the other was that until my senior year of high school, I had no idea what Christian music even was. And so, when I was getting ready to graduate, my youth pastor gave me two vinyl records, like when they were cool the first time.
Yeah.
And, One was Larry Norman's Only Visiting This Planet.
Oh, wow.
And the other was Keith Green, For Him Who Has Ears to Hear. Wow. Remember the album with the lamb around his shoulders, right?
Mm-hmm.
And so I went home and started listening to that music. And I grew up in a kind of like an artless home. You know, my mom and dad had grown up through the Depression. And I don't know, I think maybe in some ways, I lived in Michigan. We worked, my family worked in the auto industry.
Yeah.
I think maybe it felt almost like self-indulgent a little bit. Like that's for people that have more money, more time,
I get that. Yeah.
More options.
Yeah.
It was almost counterintuitive to their work ethic. You know, we had two pieces of art that hung in my house. We had the Our Daily Bread old dude with the beard.
Yeah.
And then we had Jesus knocking at the door of your heart. You know,
I had both those in my house too.
Jesus. Yeah.
I think they were, you had to, if you were a Christian back in those days, you had to have those.
That's right. It was, required to be in your home. And so when I heard this music for the first time, it was the first time that I couldn't have said it this way as a 18-year-old, but it was the first time that art and faith intersected in my life. Up until then, my only like musical connection with faith was hymns, which, you know, now you and I both love, but when I was a kid,
they're foundational for us now.
Didn't really know what a lot of those words meant, you know? And so, so fell in love with Christian music, went to a small Christian college in Indiana called Taylor University.
Yeah.
And,
rich, rich Christian music heritage.
For sure. Yeah.
Yeah.
And so, and just in a random roommate draw, I ended up with a guy named Arlen Troyer, and Arlen was a guitar player.
Yeah.
And I had never been around, and you know Arlen because he played for me. He was in the distance. He played later for the band White Art.
Right.
He toured with Stephen Curtis Chapman, was a real kind of staple bass player in the 90s CCM world. But he was an acoustic guitar player at that time, and I'd never been around a guy that could play by ear, and so it just seemed like magic, you know? He could, like, listen to a record, and he had this exhaustive Christian music collection. So, Phil Kagi, DeGarmo and Key, Servant, Petra, and let's see, there might have been even, like, some Honey Tree and Love Song and thrown in there. So, that kind of era, right?
Yeah.
And I liked, you know, some of it I didn't like, some of it I really liked. And, you know, this is the part of the story that sounds kind of goofy, but it happened. He was in a band. Again, I'd never done any music before. Their lead singer got sick, like flu, puking sick. And they were playing two songs in this variety show on campus. I later found out it was just kind of a way to make fun of freshmen, I think. Yeah. And so my roommate came, and Arlie goes, "Hey man, like, we are desperate. I've literally heard you sing just when you're goofing around. Would you be willing to sing these two songs with us?" And I was like, "Yeah, whatever. You know, you're in college. It doesn't matter." So I was like, "All right." So I agreed to do it. It was terrible. But that night we played this song called "Why Should the Devil Have All the Good Music?"
Yeah,
an old Larry Norman song.
Yeah.
You know, that we went on to record, and I have played it thousands of times all over the world. And so there was something about it.
Huh.
But we played, we were awful, but it was fun. And
well, there had to be something inside you, Jeff, though, to actually get up on that stage.
It was. Yeah, I agree.
Because the majority of people will never, ever do that.
I agree.
They're terrified to do it.
And I think, as I look back on that, I think part of it was just, you know, young, probably more confidence than sense, you know, in that time.
That's probably all of our stories.
The other thing
it?
Was, you know, God was just kind enough to.
What were you going to college
for? Let me stumble in. Business administration.
Well, that helps.
So if you need any,
in the long run,
if you need any 40-year-old financial advice, I'm up on the 1980 tax law. It's amazing. So was going to work in this whole family business.
Yeah.
And anyway, saying there was a Youth for Christ director in the crowd, and he came up and he said, "Hey man, we're doing this youth thing next month. We'd love your band to play." And I was like, "I'm in a band." It's like, literally.
What was the name of the band?
Well, we were called Portrait. Portrait.
Oh, how nice.
Or occasionally we introduced the Portraits. Terrible. Crazy, right? A guy that, you know, Arlen, that was our bass player that went on to do all that stuff. And you'll know this name, Rick Florian, and I were in that group together. So Rick went on to be the lead singer for White Heart through its golden era. And so, yeah, it was, you know, really cool. And then we learned a few more songs, and all of a sudden I was doing it. And just this crazy series of events where Taylor is right near a place called Alexandria, Indiana. Be a good Jeopardy question. What iconic Christian artist lives in Anderson, Indiana, which is right there, and that's Bill Gaither. And he had a group of guys that played for him in the Bill Gaither Trio who, you know, they were an arena act for, I don't know, 30 years, right? Starting out all through the 70s, 80s, 90s, and beyond. So you should do a show sometime just about the DNA of his musicians. So, you know, Sandy Patty, Steve Green, Lauren O'Harris, that crew, but all of his band members, Dan Huff, who is one of the greatest country producers in the world.
I can't tell the story of Christian music about Dan Huff.
For sure. And then you got all the original guys from White Heart. So Billy Smiley and Mark Gershmill and Gary Lunn, all these guys that all played for Gaither. And they would come over to Taylor. No, they were all single. There wasn't a lot of fun to be had over in the Gaither camp at that time. They'd come to Taylor and hang out, and we got to be friends. Billy Smiley and I had grown up together in Michigan, and they all moved down here and started working down here, being Nashville, and started working. And man, that was in the era of 16th Avenue and the whole, all the studio stuff. Well, and I got to come down and sing a few demos for them. And it kind of started to pique a little bit of interest in me, but that was not, that wasn't what I wanted to do.
So did you leave college though? I mean, did you
finish college?
Okay.
Yeah. Yeah. You'll love this, man. I was taking a shower before my final of college. And, my roommate said, Arlen said, "Hey man, there's a phone call for you. It's somebody from Texas." No, Alabama. I was like, "Nobody calls me from Alabama." And so I answered, and it was a guy named Roger Breland.
Oh, no,
how about
on.
That? Yeah. And,
that's crazy.
Right. So he gave me this like whole thing about truth. I didn't know about him.
No way. What year was that?
It would have been 1983.
Okay.
And I had a job in this family business called Moore Ironworks, and that's what I was going to do. And so I was flattered. In fact, this is the first time he had heard something that I had recorded with those guys. And it was the first time anybody ever said, "Hey, I like this." So it was interesting. And I think that maybe started a little something.
He was graduated. A great scout, man. He was great music scout.
Dude could see it, right?
Yeah. Uh-huh.
And then we got married to Jan, and we went to work in the family business. And this is the only job I'd ever had. And my father passed away while I was in college. And so there was a lot of like, I don't know, just sort of legacy kind of stuff.
Yeah, or
I
like felt. Like the duty, you know, as a son. Your other siblings, I mean.
Yeah, they were all out of the house by then. It was just.
But there weren't any other siblings that were going to maybe go in and take.
Oh, yeah. The family I'm sorry. Good question. Yeah. My brother and I worked in the business together. Okay. And so a lot of expectation from him, a lot of expectation from my mom. And so I remember I called, it would have been Dan Huff. I called Dan one night and we were talking and he was here in Nashville working. And he said, "Hey man, I played some of the songs that we recorded for some people and they wanted to know more about you." And then like the same week, Billy Smiley, also in the band, had called and had done the same thing. And so this is the first time I've kind of felt like, wow, this is weird. And so Jan and I started praying about just what our future should look like. And we reached a point, Andy, where we didn't know. And to this day, I can tell you, I didn't move to Nashville trying to make it in music. As I really look back, I moved to Nashville more about leaving this family business, which was in our little world, was a big thing. But the Lord really did a work in my mom's life and my brother's heart. And my in-laws are a little different story. You know, they had their daughter had married a guy that was going to be a business dude, and so
every parent's worst nightmare.
That's right. He was like, "What? Yeah,
my husband's going to be in a band."
Yeah.
Oh, yay! Yeah.
And so, yeah, moved here, and you know, and it was 1983 Halloween night, driving to U-Haul. Still remember all the trick or treaters, and. Jan had a job lined up. I was going to try and find something. Everything fell through for both of us. All the people that we were going to connect with, it all fell apart. I got a job at the Green Hills Mall, you know, working in a men's clothing store because I had Bacharach.
Bacharach.
Had a
knew
nice,
it was going to be that or Chess. Well, probably wouldn't be Chess King. Or,
no, but it could have been like that. Yeah. I had a nice suit from my wedding and I wore it for the interview. And
I just remember whenever I had money in my pocket. If I didn't have money in my pocket, I went to Chess King.
Yeah.
If I had money in my pocket, I went to Bacharach.
That's right. We were fancy that way. Yeah, man, we were So, man, I'll just tell you, we were grinding it. Man, we were grinding it. We had one crappy car and
no kids yet.
Yeah, no kids yet. Lived in a one bedroom apartment, and it tested our calling. I'll tell you that, man, because it was.
So you did feel a call. I mean, obviously, yes. You're not going to leave your family business and leave everything you know.
But when I think back on it, definitely music was something they wanted to pursue. But it was more about the step of obedience of just like saying, because I mean, from the very youngest days that I can remember, I already had my job. I knew what I was going to do. And so to step out of that became a very refining and defining part of my faith journey. And so when we left and came here to Nashville, we were the first time in my life I was without a net, you know? And so it was really, and man, that, I mean, to this day, if my wife was sitting here, we would say that that first year is what made all, we've been married 41 years, man. That first year is what made it happen. That's what kind of gave us the foundation and in our faith as well. But man, there were plenty of days in that clothing store. I was like, what am I doing? You know, and thinking I could not be any farther from where I'm supposed to be. And man, I remember one day, like, this is the greatest story, man. One day I'm leaning against the polyester slack rack and I hear a dude go, "Hey man, could you help me find some pants?" And I turned around and it was a very young and dapper Michael W. Smith. And he and I struck up a conversation and a friendship from that. And while I was, you know, like helping him buy a sport coat, he goes, "Man, I have these great managers, Mike Bland and Darren Harrell. I'd love for you to meet them." And he introduced me to some people. And literally, Andy, over the next month, I met people that I could have never gotten a meeting with, never been involved with. Mm-hmm. Bill Gaither, Greg Nelson, these are names that were, you know, really iconic people and producers in the industry. Russ Taff, who I know that you know, is one of my heroes. And so I often tell people when they're like, "Man, how do you get started? What do you, you know?" I'm like, "You know, dude, get up and do the right thing, provide for your family, go to work." Yeah. I mean, because I was faithful to just do that, he put me in a place. Like, if you filled a room of 20 people who were most influential in my music career, I met 10 of them in Baccarat clothing store.
That's incredible.
And that just, you know, that opened doors. And I had, you know, particularly a guy named Billy Smiley, who we saw at the same memorial that you and I were at. Mm-hmm. You know, he went to bat for me. And that was an era where a producer could really help an artist get a record deal.
Yeah.
And so that started a journey, man. I signed with the Benson Company as a songwriter. Quit my Baccarat job. And
what year was that?
That would have been 1984.
Okay.
And within a year from moving here, I had signed a publishing deal and signed a record deal. Uh-huh. And my first album came out in 1985. And I went on the road opening for Whiteheart.
Wow.
And then every, you know, man, 12 to 18 months for the next almost 30 years, I made a record.
Yeah.
And
that's
joined
the cycle.
Circus.
Yeah, that's the cycle that people don't understand. I think that's what, that it shortened the careers of a lot of Christian artists, including us. I mean, it was, you know, tour, make a record, tour, make a record, tour, make a record. You know, you watch the secular bands that live at a different level and
take 2 years
they
off.
They take 2 years off and write a record and maybe they toss it all and start all over again.
That's right.
And then they go out, you know.
Yeah.
That's not the way it was. And the margins were so much smaller in the Christian world.
Yeah. I was thinking about that even as I was thinking about some of the things you and I would chat about. But even as during the heyday of the distance years, which would have been basically all through the 90s, somebody sent me a picture the other day of a festival in Minnesota, Sunshine Festival is called.
Yeah.
I'm sure you played there. Uh-huh. And the first time I played there, it was at 9:30 a.m. Oh. And I don't know, they were a solid 50 people. And the rest of the festival field looked like there'd been a riot the night before, you know?
Hey, it's better than 1 o'clock and it's Six Flags in Dallas.
It's true.
You know, 110 degrees. Yeah. And there's the same number of people out there.
But they sent me a picture. I'm wearing it was so funny. I can remember this. I found a bathrobe.
And I put it on and found a newspaper and kind of did the, like, I'm just getting up. Thanks for getting up with me. And I found some of the crew brought donuts to the crowd and all that. And then, you know, like, I don't know, 10 years later or something, you know, I got to close that festival. And I think one of the things that I'm so blessed in my career is that we grinded it, you know, and nobody has ever appreciated it more. And I do think that's part of the deal today is that shelf life of stuff is so temporary and quick, you know, that, and I also think that's another reason, this is my point I wanted to make, was why you doing something like this is important, because, you know, there was an era where Christians primarily listened to Christian music, and that's really what gave you and I our careers, you know, is that, you know, I'd look out in a parking lot, there'd be 100 church vans, you know, where the youth pastor's like, hey, we're going to the show, get your tickets, do your thing, you know. And that thing that we always all longed for, that our music would be available in a lot of mainstream places, I think it began to dilute kind of our fan base, for lack of a better phrase. And so I think, you know, I don't even know if artists can do what you and I got to do.
A lot of things would have to change. I mean, they have to go back to not streaming music anymore.
Right,
and,
right.
You know, and then radio would have to be completely different.
Yeah.
And again, yeah. I, you know, our listeners are going to be like, you say this every time, Chrisman, but the
toothpaste out of the tube.
It's one of the main themes of this podcast is that, I use this term a lot, it was the Wild West.
Yeah.
And it was wonderful because all of us with all our different styles of music were on the same radio stations at the same time. It was such diversity. And those same church vans would go to a Twyla Paris concert.
100%.
And then would go to a Jeff Moore concert. Yeah. And then would go to a DC Talk concert.
Mm-hmm.
And most of the time it was affordable. But it was, you know, tickets weren't outrageous. A lot of times it was give at the door, love offering, or whatever. But you could, you know, I live in Tulsa now. And so, you know, back in the day, you could have 6-7 tours a year come through Tulsa.
Yeah.
And they'd all sell out.
Yeah.
And they'd all be great. And then you're right. At some point, it all started to dilute. And, you know, we can or can't, I don't care if we do, but get into talking about, you know, secular companies coming in and buying the labels. And
because that was a big, you know, that was a big part of and a big impact on my career in kind of an unexpected way. You know, were you guys with 4Him with one label the whole time, which is awesome. You know,
we were the Kobe Bryant of,
it took me a minute to find a home. So
we were with Benson.
I made 3 records for Benson and they all were, you know, astoundingly average sales. And then, and then I went to Sparrow, which was like the, you know, they were the really cool kid on the block at that point.
Yeah. I don't want to make anybody mad at Benson, cause I love all my Benson people, but Benson was kind of the Toyota.
Right.
And
Sparrow.
I may edit that out cause that's kind of mean, but it's kind of true. I mean, there's a little more heat on artists.
Yeah. Yeah.
Especially Sparrow. Sparrow knew what they were doing.
Yeah. So in that era, they were really crushing it. And so I made three albums for Sparrow. And that's when we became Jeff Moore in the Distance.
Yeah.
I love to refer to myself in the third person, real highlight of my day. And then I got released from there because when I signed with them, they were super into like Christian rock and more progressive music. And they found out there just weren't that many people buying it.
Yeah.
And so I was released. And that was a real kind of soul searching time for Jan and I, because if we were going to jump and go do something else, that was the moment to do it, you know? And I really didn't have a whole lot of, and maybe to give it a little historical context, you know, is you would know, man, if you wanted to tour nationally, internationally, you had to have a label.
Yeah.
You know, it's not like today, you know, label was your entree into radio and promoters and events.
And to get you into a record store.
For sure. And you couldn't get distribution for it. Yeah. And so one of the first Christian bands I ever heard that I fell in love with was DeGarmo and Key.
Yeah.
And I had met those guys and got to know them a little bit.
And they were label mates too. I mean, I had Eddie on
not
long ago. And and they were, they kept Benson afloat.
They did.
For a long time.
And in a, this is deep dive in Christian music, y'all, but,
hey, that's what we're here for.
Their manager's name is Dan Brock.
Right.
Dan, in a really thoughtful, progressive, forward-thinking move, negotiated the ownership of some of DeGarmo and Key's masters. Did Eddie talk about this?
Yes, he did.
Some of his masters. And so they needed to make a greatest hits. They were going to make a greatest hits record, and they were able to own it and do it on their own label. So they started this label called Forefront. And so I meet Eddie and I meet Dan, and Dan Brock's wife, Darlene, who at that time was starting to do a little bit of artist management. And so and they had a guy named Ron Griffin. Ron, if you're ever listening, I love you, bud. It's been a minute, but, I met with these guys, and Ron had worked as a publisher at my very first place at Benson when I was there, called Great Circle.
Great Circle.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. And, so I go and I meet with these guys, and, they had one artist. They had an artist named Larry Howard, who's a blues artist. And so they said, cause you know, I'm going to tell you, one of the truisms of music is the only thing that's harder than breaking a new artist is breaking an average selling artist that's got five albums that haven't done anything very awesome. But man, the Lord just kind of knit us together. And I signed a deal with Forefront. And I'll never forget this. This is a great Christian music story. I was getting ready to leave, and Ron Griffin said, "Hey, man, I want to play you something." He said, and you know, hip hop was starting to become kind of popular and even easing into Christian music. Mm-hmm. And he said, "Man, I got this cassette from these three dudes from Liberty."
Yep.
He goes, "Tell me what you think." And he goes, "It's crazy because like the black guy sings and the white guy raps," which was unusual at that time. Yeah. And it was obviously DC Talk. Yeah. And so, man, I spent 25 years recording at Forefront.
Wow.
And we had a lot of other cool artists that came along. Uh-huh. But our core, you know, our core stable was DC Talk, us, Rebecca St. James, and Audio Adrenaline.
Wow.
And then later, you know, Big Tent Revival was there. Mm-hmm. Stacey Rico was there. It was a lot of great artists. But that kind of...
Those guys were brilliant. I mean, they were so forward-thinking in where they knew music was going and how Christian music could ride on what was happening in the secular world to take advantage of that.
And Toby knows this because he's heard me say it, but you know, I feel like we owe a lot of our success to Toby, Mike, and Kevin at DC Talk because they sold so much that it put so much money into that business that they were able to do a lot of marketing for albums like mine. And so it made a huge difference. I mean, to give you some context, Jesus Freak, the album Jesus Freak, when it came out, in the first 7 days, sold almost 90,000 physical units only through Christian bookstores.
Wow.
No Target, no Walmart, only no streaming, no online buying. That's that many people going into a Christian bookstore and buying an album, cassette, or CD. Pretty crazy. So anyway, I remember 1 year Forefront was the number, just by a little bit, the number two largest selling album label in Christian music behind Sparrow. And Sparrow had like 250 employees, and I think Forefront had 12. So it was like, I love you, Sparrow people, you know, I love you if you're listening, but it was pretty cool. We were scrappy.
We can all talk trash about our old labels, even though we love all the people there,
because
hindsight is so clear. You know, what's funny about the DC Talk thing, I told this to Eddie when he's on the pod, that we got there, they knocked on our door when we played Liberty and handed us their demo, that same demo.
I love it.
And we threw it in the trash.
No doubt.
Because we were like, this is terrible.
This is weird.
This is, who are these guys threw in the trash?
Yeah.
And it's, you know, anytime I run into those guys, we laugh about that. And that year that Jesus Freak did so well, for him, one group of the year. And I don't even think we had a record out. And there was me and Mark and maybe Marty. We were at an after party and ran into the three of them. And I thought it was going to be like, you know, like a rumble.
A little awkward.
We started walking towards each other and I could tell they were like, And we were like, we're kind of like,
yes,
sorry. I don't, you
that's
know,
that's right.
It's not our fault.
Yeah.
But
it was a great era. And that whole Forefront thing was really honored to be a part of that. The Darlene Brock, Dan's wife, ended up being my manager through that whole time. And yeah, it was like it was a very special fraternity that we had.
Well, there was a pretty special fraternity back in those early Benson writing days too.
Agreed. Yeah.
I mean, again, one of the things you can kind of knock Benson for was not knowing who they had and not taking advantage of it. And one of those was your buddy, Steven, who was a staff writer there.
Yep.
And
I think, man, if I remember,
they had Carmen.
I think there was a time that, for sure, I think there was a time that Twyla Paris wrote for them. Yep. I think Wayne Watson wrote for them for a time. Yeah, and that was...
Sandy was on their label for a long time.
Yep.
And it was... That's when we got the Benson, you know, DeGarmenke had just left, which was kind of their bell cow.
See that? Yeah, because my first three albums were on Power Disc, which was the same label that they were on. I couldn't believe it. When I remember the first time I looked at that vinyl, it had the same label as DeGarmenke.
Isn't that a cool feeling?
This is unbelievable.
Yeah, it's a cool feeling to see your name on the same. Again, so many of these conversations too, we reference that thing you do.
Yeah.
And how just right Tom Hanks got that whole movie.
No doubt.
And it's just like, that's exactly how it is.
I'm signing, you're signing, we're all signing.
Radio for the first time and running, screaming down the street or, you know, seeing your name on the charts for the first time or, you know, seeing your name on the same, you know, the Playtone stable of stars, you know,
where
our name is on there too.
That's crazy. Incredible. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, let's go back to Stephen Curtis here for a minute, because again, that's a big part of your story.
It is,
because your name is on one of the biggest songs in the history of Christian music.
It is. Yeah.
And, I mean, tell me how that song came about. Was that how long had y'all been writing together before you wrote
for
that
quite
song?
Quite a few years.
Did y'all meet each other?
We met each other
at Benson.
Yeah. We met at Benson. It was, I had sung a demo it was a song that Steven had written. He was Steve Chapman in those days. A song that Steven had written, and he wasn't there. They were just recording some demos to pitch to some people. And I remember it was a song called Built to Last was the name of it. And the Imperials ended up recording it. And but Steven liked my singing, and I really liked the song. And I thought, man, this would be cool. And so who are the powers that be made an appointment for us to meet together. So we met... this little writing, it was Paragon Music over on Hayes Street in Nashville. And I'd been married for like 6 months longer than he had. And he always kids that, you know, I was the authority. So he was going to, you know, glean the wisdom. And I don't think we didn't write anything that day, but man, we really hit it off. And we talked a lot about our lives. And we have kind of similar experiences of growing up in very conservative environments and not really knowing what was going on in the church. I remember, man, both of us, the first time we started playing in really charismatic churches, we were just freaked out, you know.
Let's say
he and I wrote a song for me called Listen to Our Hearts that we did as a duet. And really a lot of that initial idea was born out of we're singing in all these different churches. They have all these different worship expressions, you know. I don't know what's right, I don't know what's wrong, I don't know what's best, I don't know what's weird, what's whatever, you know.
Yeah.
So, but I know this one thing, you know, here's our hearts on it. But so, that first day we introduced our wives and, man, dude, that was, 35 years ago or more. And they're our best friends today. It's my Jan and Mary Beth are literally best friends. And so the journey that we've had together is you can't make it up. So, so we started writing originally for me. Steven actually came on the road with me for about 6 months and played guitar and a little bit of piano. And it was during while he was getting writing to record his first album. So he thought it might be good to get a little road experience. So we had some fun and, he definitely hadn't been in a van with a bunch of dudes, you know, before. So it was a little eye opening for him. And, he was like, "You are the most sarcastic people I've ever met." And I was like, "Dude, get a thick skin. Let's go. If you're not getting teased a little bit, there's
that's
a problem
right.
here.
That's
and,
right.
And
we so, don't like you. If we're not,
that's
we're,
right. That's right.
If we're not but, cutting you to pieces, we don't like you.
We did learn to take it easy on the Kentucky boy. So, and then, And so on my second or third album, we wrote a few songs together, and then on his first album, and man, we were talking about it the other night. You know, we both had small kids, and we would, you know, we would get, they would come to our house, we put all the kids to bed, then he and I'd go in the back of the kitchen and play and work, quietest place we could find, and same thing at his house, or we would sleep over or whatever. So, but the songs really were just born out of a real kind of shared community. We came up in the same church, Christ Community Church. Scotty Smith is our pastor. Mm-hmm. Still a dear presence in both of our lives. We owe him a lot of back royalties. I mean, we still, there's nobody we stole more lyrics from than Scotty Smith. And, and so, but specifically talking about The Great Adventure, Stephen had a lot of that song written when he called me, which he always teases me about. He's like, "You're the king of the second verse and the bridge and the vowel sounds," you know. It's like, hey man, without the whoa-ohs, what is
that's
that
right
song?
What is it,
you know? And we had gone on, you know, around that, we wrote Friend Like You and Home Run around that same time that have a lot of vowel sounds. So he teases me that that's the bit that I wrote. And but I just, you know, I loved his idea of faith as an adventure. So much of Christian music at that time was very kind of serious and reflective. There wasn't a lot of fun music out there. And so I thought that was really great. And then two cool memories of that. One is that if you ever get to see the music video of Stephen riding this horse on this ranch in Wyoming, you should see it, because it looks like he's really digging it, but he's actually terrified because the horse is going crazy. He about killed him. There's a big prelude, you know, that Jack Redford wrote to The Great Adventure, which is so beautiful, man. Yeah. And, a couple years ago, Stephen played at Carnegie Hall, and this big symphony played that. And then he and I was privileged to write another beautiful song of his called Speechless. Yeah. And there's a, you know, the bridge, there's a bridge in that song. You know, we stand in all of you. And I can remember when we were working on that melody, we were actually like whistling this part, because it, for whatever reason, we were whistling it, and then listened to the New York Philharmonic play these notes of these things that we had whistled in the basement in the middle of the night when our kids were sleeping.
What an incredible feeling that has to be, just after all these years, even decades, to hear your songs, you know, not reimagined, but enhanced in a way to where it there's another level it can go to. And I mean, that's just,
oh gosh, have you seen this, the Week Away movie? Do you know the Week Away movie? It's
I don't think so.
Some of your listeners are going to go, come on, Andy, what are you talking about? It's like a, it's sort of I'm awful, my kids have gotten too old now, High School Musical. It's like a High School Musical kind of thing, but it's about a camp, and they use a bunch of classic Christian songs in it that have been re-recorded. Okay.
I've heard about this.
So they use some Amy Grant songs. They use For King and Country, Rich Mullins, and but they do The Great Adventure in that, and there's like a full dance scene to it, you know, and it's super great. And my girls were just like looking at me, shaking their head. I was like, I told you, I'm still super cool. So,
and I just paid for dinner tonight.
That's right. Yeah. That is right. And man, I always, whenever I have an opportunity, you know, to talk about Stephen, because, you know, we walked through Dark Night of the Soul when his little girl was killed. And, you know, Jan and I have two adopted Chinese daughters, and that was one of their very best friends in the world. And to watch he and his family navigate that experience very much in the public eye. I mean, you guys know statistically no marriages survive losing children, particularly when they're little like that. And to watch those guys fight it out and allow God to meet them. And, you know, if I've heard Stephen say it once, I've heard him say it 1,000. We said it at Don's funeral. I said it to his kids. I'm like, guys, it's either true or it's not. And if it's true, we're going to live like we have hope.
Willing to see how they navigated their kids through that as well.
100%. Yeah. Well. And so it that was a great privilege to be able to, as hard as it was a great privilege to be able to walk through that with them, and to watch the Christian music community come up around them. And, you know, there was an enormous amount of money given that went into an incredible orphan care and adoption care. And, you know, for all of its horror, there was, you know, some really beautiful but hard things that came out of it. Yeah. You know, as Mary Beth often says, I would just really like to have my daughter back. Yeah. You know, by no means are we saying, you know, right. worth it.
Right.
We're saying that right. out of the ashes, God yeah. raised up some good
stuff.
And
again, as horrible as it was, it really shined a spotlight on Christian adoption agencies.
It did.
It turned the corner for so many
That's
of those
right.
organizations.
That's right. And, you know, I was privileged to be one of the early board members at Show Hope and yeah. watch navigate all that. Because you will love this, man. People will ask me, they're like, how did you get involved in this or that or whatever? I'm like, look, if you are a songwriter and you write a song about anything, you'll get involved. I'm like, if you have a hangnail and you write a song about it, you will sing at the National Hangnail Convention if you want to, you know, yeah. they'll pull you in.
Yeah.
So the cool thing is that a lot of the things that I've written about through the years and adoption stuff being one of those, it pulled me into that culture where I played at a lot of events and things mm-hmm. like that. And man, met so many amazing people. And I mean, doesn't it feel like looking, you know, back at a lot of our music career, just like the access that it gave us to meeting people and
yeah.
seeing amazing things. And
yeah.
to me, the music's like a key, you know, it opens doors.
It really does.
That you really couldn't open any other way. Uh-huh. And people don't, you know, it's like, I don't belong here. You know, so yeah. you've had plenty of those moments.
Oh,
I
yeah.
know, brother, well, where you're like, how did I get here?
I want to bring up our common friend, Tim Burke.
Yes.
Yeah, Tim Burke's a big part of both of our stories.
Absolutely.
Because I'll never forget Tim, and I'm going to have Tim on the
Please
on
do.
At some point. His story's just amazing.
I need to be the third guy to keep him honest, probably.
Yeah.
But.
yeah. We'll bring you on as a fact checker.
Yeah.
But yeah, I'll never forget seeing his just a little blur, a little quick conference on ESPN when he was announcing his retirement.
Yeah.
After he just signed with the Yankees. Is that right?
The Reds. He
the
was
Reds.
Just with
yeah,
the Reds
right.
when he left.
He
but he had been with the Yankees before
right.
that. Yeah.
He just signed with the Reds and said that he was going to go home and take care of his family. And he talked about the basics of life. And,
yeah.
you know,
yeah,
and just like, this is what I want to do with the rest of my life. And,
yeah.
and you know, it's people like that that, you know, and I know you probably have a dozen stories of people in the sports world or
yeah.
in politics and, I mean, so far, music is, you're right, music is a key that if we didn't have that, we wouldn't be able to have access to some of these people's lives, and then they become dear yeah. friends of ours. And Tim's, I love to hear Tim's stories about you guys riding Harleys.
Yeah, dude,
those
we've
were
had,
some...
and he's still one of my dearest friends, and he'll love that we're together. He, man, he loves For Him, and that music. Talk about a soundtrack of somebody's life. I mean, I wish it was my music, but it was really y'all's music.
Wow.
I mean, I know he served on a ministry board for y'all.
Yes, he
and
did.
Traveled with you.
Mm-hmm.
And he did that a lot for me too. For those of you who don't know, Tim Burke is a retired professional baseball player, middle reliever, and is an amazing guy.
Yeah.
Has led a lot of the main ministry through the National Hockey League for the last two decades. And, to just a really special guy to both Andy and I, but yeah, he's a trip, man. I love that dude.
He's fun. Yeah. I'll never forget Marty one time saying, I want to catch a fastball from Tim.
Yeah.
And Tim's like, no, you don't. He's like, I could yeah. literally kill you.
Yeah.
But Marty talked him into it.
He lied him up.
I think we were at a hotel somewhere, or it was like a motel. Like, I remember the doors being outside and Marty crouched down and Tim's like, I'll give it to you about three quarters.
Yeah.
Okay.
Yeah.
And Marty said his hand hurt. We heard the pop.
I love it.
You know, like half a mile away. And Marty's like, yeah, okay, yeah, I'm done. I'm
not gonna do that. We did, you know, when my song Home Run, when we did the music video for that,
yeah,
it was
yeah,
at the old
right.
Nashville Sound Stadium
uh-huh.
and Tim was the pitcher in it. And
yeah.
And so we were just looking at some pic. We went through for Don Cook's memorial. My wife went through and found some old pictures and we came up, it was that same era,
yeah.
came across a bunch of pictures with him too. So yeah,
we all
he's
had
a
similar
brother.
Hair back then.
That's right. We
well.
Did.
Yeah.
yeah.
The nice little full, it wasn't, I see people call it mullets.
Yeah.
I don't think they were mullets. They weren't the traditional
no.
like Billy Ray Cyrus
no.
mullet where it was short here and long in the back. It was, I mean, then the whole thing was all...
It was just kind of long and wrong, right?
Yeah, it was like...
it was a lot, yeah, it's a lot going on.
Yeah, long and wrong. That's a good way to put it. So here's a question I thought about earlier today. You and Stephen wrote so many songs together. Did you write for each other's records, or did you write just to write? And if you did you ever kind of go, well, I want that for my record. Wait, I want that for my record.
Well, we did write... We usually wrote artist specific out for our album, our specific albums. That was usually because typically we would have had something started when we got with each other. And so we wrote a few songs for some outside people, but not a bunch. And then I don't remember there ever being, I think Listen to Our Hearts is probably the only one that because Steven's career started to go pretty good at that point. He was like, you know, we'd probably make more money from this if I recorded it. I was like, you're an idiot. So thanks. Anyway, it was, yeah, I think that was about the only one. And he ended up recording it, which is sweet. You know, cool. That song, Casting Crowns, recorded a few years ago.
Oh, wow.
And Steven and I went in and sang with Mark on it. Oh, so it was really fun. That was a cool thing.
Wow.
Too.
So, Let's talk about kind of where your touring career and your recording career started to, because everybody but Steven obviously has a career arc.
Yeah.
Where you get to a point for him had it.
Yep.
Where we're kind of looking at going, I think this is it. I think this is kind of the end of the road. We could probably go to Branson and open up a theater,
right?
Which some people had talked to us about. I'm like, is that going to be fun? I don't know.
Yeah.
I don't know if I want to do that or not.
Yeah.
But you start to think, okay, what's next?
Yeah.
When was that for you?
Well, it would have been the late 90s. You know, music was starting to change. I could feel it. And, you know, there was, I won't even remember all the band names, but, you know, there were a lot, it was more alternative music. And so this is an interesting thing I was thinking about earlier when we were talking about just kind of the importance of recording the history of Christian music, is that, you know, because Christian music is such a, it's a smaller, you know, fan base, it doesn't preserve itself like Bruce Springsteen's music does. Or, you know, I grew up in Michigan. I once saw Bob Seger 2 years ago at his last show, you know.
I missed that tour.
There was, you know, it was completely sold out, you know. Tickets were super expensive, and here's a dude, 74, right? But they've got this, they can lose all the ancillary outside fans, but they had such a huge core of fans, you know, that people continued to come see them. And in Christian music, you know, that isn't so much the case. And so I think there was a couple of things. One was, I was committed, and I always told my guys in the distance this. I was like, fellas, we are not going to stay too long at this party. You know, it's not going to be the one where it's like, you were awesome 15 years ago. Yeah. You know, muffin top, leather pants, let's go. Right. And so none of that.
Flatbed trailer.
That's right.
Yeah.
Not doing it. Yeah. And so I really wanted to protect that legacy if we could. And the other one was, because you couldn't, at least most artists couldn't sustain a really core fan base on the same kind of music, it would have required some sort of reinvention.
Yeah.
And
that's so hard.
Yeah. And I didn't really feel called or compelled to do that. I also knew that I, you know, Lord willing, would have a career as a songwriter and maybe a solo artist with more of a singer songwriter thing, which happened. And, you know, I made another 5 or 6 albums after that. And so after, and I knew even in my relationship with Forefront, I had another recording option. I had a couple albums left with them, and they had agreed to do solo records with me after that. And so, man, the guys in the distance had given, you know, they gave some great years to me, and I tried to take good a care of them as I could take, and we're still dear friends today. You know, it's a great.
We inherited Roscoe.
Yes, you did.
Yeah,
that's right.
And loved having him play for us for
great
season.
And, you know, it's just so a great legacy of all of that. You know, Jeff Barkley played keyboards for me, went on and played for Third Day for years. But I went to them a year in advance, and I said, all right, fellas, this is your 1 year notice, you know, a year from. It was like August, I think. A year from now, we'll be done. And so it was really a sweet thing. There was definitely times, you know, it'd be a great crowd or whatever. You'd be like, are we doing this? You know,
yeah.
are we jumping ship a little early? You know, but I was happy to do it a little earlier than a little bit late, a little bit too late. And so, I think maybe I don't remember the exact years, 2099, somewhere in there, we played our last show it was at the University of Central Florida, and it was this awesome show. It was a Billy Graham thing, and we had a great last one, and, you know, I cried through the entire set, and it was a sweet, bittersweet end to it, but everything felt great. And here's a story I don't think I've ever told in a public forum before. We did that last show, and Stephen Curtis was doing a series of church dates, like 10 Southern Baptist churches in the South. And he had asked me, it was during Speechless, and he had said, I think looking back, he literally was like, man, I know it's going to be super hard for you to end this. Why don't you come out and we'll do like a little songwriter thing in the middle of my set. So I agreed to do that. And that ended up being really, really sweet. Cause you know, it was just he and I sitting on stools, and it gave me a glimpse into what could be next, yeah. You know? And then I played, and then the last show of that run, I did this conference, like youth conference, that originally had been booked as a distance show like 2 years before. And I get there, and it's, I'm trying to think who was there. I know it was like, Kirk Franklin was there. Oh, wow. And Jars of Clay. It was Jars of Clay and Kirk Franklin. And they're both like at the zenith of their careers, you know? And so Jars of Clay plays the Unson Arena, and then Kirk Franklin plays, and then he's supposed to bring the crowd down and introduce me. And I'm going out there with an acoustic guitar player. It's Roscoe. Acoustic guitar player, lead a couple worship songs and do a talk and then give an invitation. And so... And, you know, Kirk Franklin could not have screwed it up more. You know what I mean? If he finished on 10, he introduced me at 11. And so I walked out there. And man, I can remember Andy just being like, what am I doing here? And so we led a couple worship songs, and it was sweet. And then I just talked about the gospel, and it was a big place. I went back to my room, and I was literally discouraged. And I remember I got up next morning, there was a note under my door, and it said, hey, Jeff, just thought you might like to know that like 650 people gave their lives to Jesus last night. And I was, man, you talk about crying like a baby. And that was a pretty pivotal moment for me to just say that season with the distance was awesome. And it's what it was. And that the Lord has more for me after that. And so that, yeah, God, I think that tour with Stephen and then that event with good old Kirk Franklin was important.
You know, that's the great thing about, yeah, not to pat ourselves about what we're able to do, but there's so many options. Mm-hmm. But when we're in something that's really successful,
yeah.
That was the hard thing about for him was it was hard for us to, and I was kind of the first one. I did the same thing with the other three guys. Yep. Went, hey, I'm going to give you a year.
Yeah.
And I think I'm supposed to go on and do other things. This is the end for me.
Mm-hmm.
And even though it was difficult to walk through that season, all four of us found so much undiscovered territory that God had for us if we were willing to leave what had worked was comfortable. Yeah. When you talk about, you know, there is that thing. You're like, oh, wait, we just sold another show out.
Yeah.
Oh, wow, they're going crazy tonight.
Yeah.
We're fools for leaving this. When God's going, no.
Yeah.
No, go. Go out while you've got something to be thankful for.
Right.
Don't write it all the way down until you, because you can become bitter and you can become disillusioned and go, you can almost shake your fist at God, even if you've had this great run and go,
that's right.
Where did they all go?
Instead of just being thankful for it. Yeah. And man, you think, and I don't mean to speak for you, but I think about what the local church, how you have served the local church and the gift that your music and worship leading and pastoral heart has been to the local church, man. I mean, think you'd have missed all that by being in Branson. You know what I'm saying? Isn't it crazy that there was a time when you would have, I would speculate, there was a time that you would have thought being a worship leader at a church was like a huge step down.
Well, that was the consolation
from what you
prize,
were doing. Yeah.
Wasn't
it? Right.
If you couldn't make it in Christian music,
Sing our music in your church. It'll be awesome.
Right. Well, and that went all the way back to Truth for me.
Right.
Is when you finished your run in Truth, you would try to, you'd go to Nashville and try to make it. And if you didn't make it and get signed, you'd go take a church somewhere.
Yeah. Yeah.
And that was always looked at as second place.
Right. Right.
Until you run that race for a season and go, it's not second place. It's actually, it might be our first calling.
No doubt.
You know, and I know it was for me.
Yep.
And I loved what you did, you know, towards the, you know, when you started doing some of your solo stuff, there was a lot more worship and,
yep.
And yeah. dedication to, you know, we had told our stories
yes.
of our life in Christ. Now let's spend some time talking about who God is.
Yeah.
Be a little more vertical.
Yep.
And I think we all needed to stretch that muscle. And that's, you know, that's when worship kind of came in and took everything
that's
over.
That's right.
But it all comes back around, doesn't it?
Yep. Yeah. Think, yeah. You know, that was such a great, and I think it's great. I mean, to be able to do those solo albums was really meaningful to me. And, yeah, write about different things or write with different people and different producers mm-hmm. and kind of get out of that lane of doing, you know, the old, if it ain't broke, don't fix it
yeah.
kind of mentality.
But it does feel like, I mean, not to, you know, not to shed a negative light on this at all, but didn't it feel like a kind of a little bit of a hamster wheel after a while?
Oh, yeah, for sure.
Because we talked about that early on when we first started talking. Yeah. It's tour, 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 make a record, tour, 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 make. You're going to the same venues year yeah. after year.
Well, and I know you have this feeling, and I don't know, for those of you listening, if this just sounds super weird, but like today, people walk up and go, hey, man, I saw you at this place at this time. Mm-hmm. And there's always a little twinge in me that's like, man, I hope it was a good night. I yeah. hope that I was in a good place, you know,
because
uh-huh. sometimes, you know, you're sideways with your wife or
yeah.
money's tight or you're struggling with whatever, you know, you're exhausted and all those things. And so mm-hmm. I've always told people, you know, because I've just said, man, I don't remember that specific thing, but I remember that era.
Yeah.
And I know that we were trying to mean it and
yeah.
try and give our best every night. Oh, and I hope that you felt that.
I feel the same way. I have people come up to me all the time and go, hey, I met you in, you know, in San Bernardino
yeah,
in
yeah.
1989.
Right.
And I'm like, oh, I hope I made it good in there.
Yeah.
And they're like, oh, you were so wonderful.
You're yeah.
So, I'm like, oh, thank Ooh, God.
Good night. Yeah.
Ooh, thank you, Lord. That's because yeah. I do. I, you know, there's a little bit of that I live in fear of it going, oh, how many, you look back and go, how many times was I just a rear end of people?
Right.
Because we were human, right?
Yes.
I tell yeah. you, you know, Wayne Watson really set me free from that. He toured with us one season, and he really set me free from that trap of mm-hmm. thinking I have to be everything to everyone all the time.
Yeah.
And he's like, it's okay to be yourself. It's yeah. okay to hurt.
Yeah.
It's okay to be tired. It's okay to walk away and tell people, say, hey, I appreciate all of you, but I have to go now.
Yeah.
I have to go be by myself now. Yeah. I have yeah. to go home now.
Yeah.
And you know, that I carried some of those mentors in my life through those years helped me today.
Yeah.
Because, you know, even getting into the, you mentioned being in the worship space.
Yeah.
You know, there's some times there too, where you can, you know, people come and say, I saw you lead worship, or I talked to you after a worship conference. And I'm like,
right.
And the same feelings come back going, oh no, I hope I made a good impression.
Yeah.
I hope I didn't say anything that ruined your day.
Right.
But we're
right.
allowed to be ourselves. And, you right. know, I think that's something we can look back on too and go, you know, I don't feel like we have to fear
yeah.
that, because we were doing our best.
Yep. And that is one of the things I love about the music culture and community now, is I feel like that's encouraged more.
Yeah.
And there's a little bit more freedom for people to be themselves. And
it's a double-edged sword.
Mm-hmm.
Let me just say that
Agreed.
Too, you know, because
right.
they're, and then when people are themselves, we go, ooh, I don't know if they should be saying that
that's
or doing
right.
that or,
yeah.
you know, have that,
yeah.
have that view on society.
But dude, we're at a point where if we get canceled, that'll yeah. be like good for business. You know what
yeah,
I'm saying?
Exactly. Any news is good news
that's
at this
right.
point, right?
That's right.
Careers. Let's talk about what you're doing now.
Yeah.
So, you know, again, I want to talk after this is over just to,
for sure.
you know, because of our ministry at the worship table and what
yeah.
you're doing. I love
yeah.
it. You know, you've got a place where you're ministering to people and
yeah,
taking them on great adventures. Can I use it?
It's a crazy story, man.
Yeah.
It's like, you know, and so, you know, in a lot of the era that we've been talking about when we were, you know, touring so much, I mean, it's like being in the circus, right? I mean,
yeah.
it really is,
yeah.
you know, and I saw an old picture of a show the other day that somebody, a photographer taken from like somewhere up above the stage, and And there was a piece of tape on the front of the stage that said, "You are in Toledo, Ohio," mm-hmm, you know? Yep. And I'm just like,
yep,
you know, isn't that crazy to think that we had to be reminded of what city we were in?
Well, I've
you
said
know?
The wrong city several times.
Yes. Yeah. Nothing put a damper on it. Like, yeah, good to be in the wrong city. So, and I heard a guy say this the other day. He was talking about being really busy, and he goes, I wasn't burned out, but I was overheated. I thought, you know, that's a good analogy, because that's how I felt. I was like, this is great. I just don't think this is sustainable, you know? And every one of us have friends that we have watched, you know, sacrifice their family, their health, whatever, on the kind of altar of ministry. And so, I had some good people in my life that were just like, man, you need to, you know, slow it down a little bit and figure out some, how to get some margin in your life. And, you know, I started playing golf again. I'd grown up playing golf, got away from it. It was a big part of my friendship with Toby Mack, is that he and I love play golf together. So that helped me a lot. And then, but I grew up in the woods. I grew up hunting and fishing, and that was really my, just kind of my sort of connection with creation and the thing that I loved the most. And I'd gotten away from it. You know, we moved to Nashville. I didn't have any place to go or whatever. So, the quickest piece of the story is I was playing a show at a Christian college in South Dakota, and I met a guy that took me hunting day of the show. He was like, you ever pheasant hunted? And I was like, no. And he goes, you want to go? And I was like, yeah, like a year from now, maybe I can squeeze it in. He's like, I mean, right now, you know, what time sound check, you know? So literally we got in the school van and went, and that kind of started a little something in my heart. I met another guy out there that had a farm, and I took a group of guys from Nashville on a pheasant hunting trip, and Eddie DeGarmo was one of those guys. And we were sitting around a fire one night, you know, we'd made a dinner, and man, Andy, if I can put into words, I just felt like God just said, pay attention to this. And I logged it back there, because it was I was still playing a lot, but it was years later. But, I began to take a few more people on trips, and it turns out there's a lot of people that would love to go on trips, but they don't know where to go, and they don't have the stuff, and
or who to go with.
That's right. And you and I have this in common, that that in many ways we built our careers, were built on, I'll use this phrase, on the back of the local church.
Yeah,
it was a local church that made our music careers possible. Mm-hmm. Whether it was a venue, whether it was them coming to shows, or it was them putting our songs into their services or worship, whatever.
Right.
And like you, through the years, I became friends with a lot of pastors, and I began to get a glimpse behind the curtain of what a hard job it is, and how isolating it can be, and how literally, talk about unsustainable, so many of these guys' environments they find themselves in, where they can't be honest to anybody because they'll lose their job, and they don't have very many friends, and they're underpaid, and they're overworked, and they have people have ridiculous expectations of them and all this stuff. So, I just felt like the Lord said, hey man, it's time to pay back a little bit. And so, I started a little nonprofit to raise some money to take some of my pastor buddies on some outdoor trips. And that little idea has kind of grown into sort of what my great life's work is. I feel like I've had two great callings in my life. One was to go into Christian music, and the other was to lead this ministry called Fellowship Adventures. And, you know, this year we'll take about 500 people in ministry on outdoor adventure trips. We have lodges we have a place in Nebraska and a place in South Dakota and a place up in Ontario, Canada, where we fish. And, you know, I basically have leveraged a bunch of the relationships that I had in music. You know, that like one of the guy that's on my board now for Fellowship Adventures is Wes Stafford. Yeah. Wes was the longtime president of Compassion International. When he was serving in that role, he came and said, hey, would you curate a trip for us? And we'll bring some board members and donors. And, you know, we went fishing, and, you know, it's hard to explain, Andy, but it's hard to say, you know, if you do the right thing in the right place, you can go into these wild wilderness places and things get done that would never get done in a boardroom or in a meeting somewhere. And so, I'll give you an example. Compassion International has been a great partner of mine my entire music career. They sponsored a lot of my tours, and I love the ministry. I've been on 80 trips with them around the world. And, you know, I talked about them at our shows a lot. There were tens of thousands of kids sponsored through that. And in doing that for almost 30 years, in 5 years of partnering them with Fellowship Adventures, where pastors come in and hear about Compassion's work in some wilderness lodge somewhere, there's been about 5x more kids sponsored through that piece right there. So to see how God has taken another thing and kind of nurtured it. And yeah, it's fellowshipadventures.org. If you've got a ministry person in your life that you love, that you think they could use a trip outside where there's nothing expected of them. And we'd love to know about it. That's what we do.
I think this is wonderful. And I think it's a growing need. I think it's something that God has put on your heart and so many other people's hearts across the country to help people in ministry kind of get out of their world for a little bit, turn their phones off, you know, probably the places that you've got, there's not a lot of cell service or, you know, I've been,
and even if there is, it's inappropriate to be on your phone
much. No Wi-Fi, and you get out and you can decompress a little bit. Yeah. You can have somebody put their arm around you. And
some of it's camaraderie too.
That's what I was going to say.
I think a lot of times having guys, you know, like we did the way that I met our mutual friend, Drew Powell, you know, is that he introduced me to a group of worship guys, you know? And so we had a whole group of guys come to our Nebraska ranch. They were just some kind of creative arts guy. You know, they were either the worship leader or they were the creative arts director or whatever. And, you know, you're rarely in a room. I mean, part of what you and Mark and your friends are doing through your worship table, thank you, is, I mean, that it's the same DNA. You know, you're getting people into a safe environment. You know, it's part encouragement, it's part commiseration. Some of it's just nothing. Some of it's just, you know what, I'm going to take a minute and not talk about anything to do with church life or music or anything, you know? And it's just amazing that and I'll keep this short, but I believe that one of the great tools of the enemy against human beings is to isolate us, you know, to use ranching vernacular to cut you out of the herd, and you lose your perspective of what life's really like, who loves you, who cares about you, what things are valued. And that's when the enemy gets you alone. That's when he can begin to whisper lies into your life that are, I think, heard better than when you are with a community of people. And so we create these kind of micro fraternities and even some sororities now, where we allow like-minded people to come together where they have no expectations. And God's raised up some really faithful folks to help support us that allows us to be able to fund tons of these trips. And I think that's part of the beauty of it. I mean, being a pastor is never going to get easy, ever. And so you can't sit around hope, you know, I don't completely believe, but you know, that old phrase, hope is not a strategy in this situation. That's true.
Yeah.
You can't hope that all of a sudden it's going to get easy. It's not.
Yeah.
And so a buddy of mine, you may know Josh Turner, buddy of mine, you know, Josh and his ministry 1010 is a big partner with Fellowship Adventures, and they call it triage, you know, instead of triage, before, they call it triage.
Just get there before anything
helping
bad
people
happens.
Before they get sick. So it has been a great privilege. And just over the years, I kind of went from like 80-20 music Fellowship Adventures to 50-50. And now it's about 80-20 outdoor work and music. I still get to travel and play and do a few really fun things. And
well, that's what I was going to ask. Do you still get to go out and do concerts?
And you know, probably like you, I get to do all manner of things.
Yeah.
I don't tour anymore, but Stephen and I usually do several shows a year together. Like he just did an Alaskan cruise, and I went and we sang together, and we did
cruises will always be on the on the horizon.
We did
for
a
guys
whole
like
set
us.
Of just songs we had written together, which was cool, and then and a lot of benefit stuff. You know, the old saying, if you can stay around long enough, all your buddies run stuff, you know? So
I've
got a lot of pastor friends that are like, please come into our church. And, you know, so I I sing in 10 or 15 churches a year and lead with some worship and play some, you know, some of the oldies but goodies. And then, you know, I'm able to do a lot of benefit kind of work and work with a lot of ministries that I love. And then Jan, I don't know what your situation's like, but my wife's like, she's traveling with me a lot more, but it's very location specific.
Oh my gosh.
Right.
That's exact same
so way. Yeah. I'm like, hey babe, I'm playing in Orlando. She's like, we're in Orlando, you know, or whatever.
Well, I'm coming.
So we've got, she gets to come.
Not so much Wichita.
Right.
But,
that's right. Gets to do some fun stuff.
Wichita listeners.
That's right.
Actually a really beautiful Wichita place, and right, especially in the spring.
It is. Yes.
Yeah. But yeah, same
so
way.
So I do a little bit of music and a lot of our work through Fellowship Adventures, but it keeps me attached to a ton of great ministries. You know, we work with about 15 different national ministries that we kind of help, that we believe in, and we kind of help drive their mission forward. And it's so cool, man, how, you know, there's this later song I wrote called The Next Thing that is like, was like my perspective on, as you're ending one thing and preparing to do something else, kind of how do you reconcile your past with your future? And for anybody that's in that situation, man, I would just remind you that if whatever you're doing right now, that, if you're in some way trying to walk out a faithful life, God's preparing you for something else, you know? And you and I are great examples of that, right? I mean, we did one thing for a long time. We got to do it at a super high level and we're very blessed to do it. But there was even better days ahead that we didn't even know about, you know, that God created for us. So yeah, be encouraged that, you know, God's not done with you, even if one thing is ending.
Hey, thanks for listening. Join me every Monday for new stories from the Christian music industry and beyond. If you want more content like this, along with a lot of great music, join me for Worship with Andy Christman, airing on 500 stations around the world every weekend. And when you get a sec, run over to my website, andychristman.net, for information about my professional vocal coaching and an incredible new resource for worship pastors called The Worship Table. See you next time on the One Degree of Andy podcast.